Beauty Unplugged, the podcast. Welcome to yet another episode of my podcast, She Unplugged. And today, in the midst of the crisis we're all living through, I've got actually, for me, and I think for you, the listener and the viewer, the perfect guest. Because my perfect guest today is helping us, and I say us consciously, is helping us to get through crises and difficult situations by using certain tools. And those tools she's not using just for the fun of it, because no, she's using them because she had to out of her own life story. And I'm very curious to hear a little bit from that. Betty Ann, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm so delighted to be with you and with your listeners today. And I hope that everything we talk about will be meaningful and will be for everyone's highest good.
Yeah, that's a lovely intention. We keep that in mind. Betty Ann, let us start by just introduce yourself to the audience. So I know you're located in Canada, but what do you do in Canada?
Well, I'm talking to you today from my lake house, which is outside of Toronto. I was born and raised in a small town in Saskatchewan, which is in the agricultural prairie heart of our country. And I had my career there, and I was a corporate executive, and I worked for a large mining company. I traveled to Europe often to see investors and to talk to companies that we might be interested in buying. And so I had a very well-established corporate career, and then I decided I'm basically a person that likes to grow, and everything I had done there, I felt like I've been there, done that, got the t-shirt, even the keychain. And so I decided that I could afford, luckily, to quit my job and pursue things that I thought were more in line with maybe my higher purpose. And so since then, I have been focused on helping women advance in the workplace, because I know it's very difficult for women in male-dominated businesses especially, and I knew that coming from the mining business. I designed and sponsor a program at our university for working women to help them find mentors in the workplace, because that's proven to be a way that they keep women in the workplace. And I've done a lot of speaking, and my experiences as a corporate executive, a single woman for much of my career on the management team with a lot of men, got me very interested in the topic of gender. So we could do an entirely separate session on gender. And I ended up writing a book called Gender Physics, which is all about how people are born, they're labeled pink or blue, and with that, we heap all these expectations on them as to how they should live and act, and how I think that's to our detriment, because we're then stopping ourselves from expressing ourselves as individuals. So I speak about that, and interestingly, last year, the Canadian Institute of Mining named me as one of their distinguished speakers. So it was meant that I went around to a lot of mining conferences talking about how men didn't need to act in ways that we traditionally thought were masculine, and it was to their advantage to adopt many of the attributes we typically think of as being feminine. And I also, of course, since COVID, have done a number of online Zoom calls where I've talked as well to more, since then, has been women in mining organizations. And so that's been very gratifying. So I've done lots of things in my post-corporate career that have been gratifying, that I feel like have made a difference to women who are finding their way, you know, so it's my way of providing a handout or a hand up.
Let's just go back to the industry we're working in. I mean, I know from our previous conversations that you basically worked, I mean, the mining industry is a male-dominated world. And you also told me at the time when we talked that you lift out those attributes too, you know. I mean, tell me a little bit about why did you think it was necessary to live out those male attributes, and how did they show up in the day-to-day business?
First of all, I think that since the Industrial Revolution, we've had cultural values that say efficiency is where it's at. And the more you produce, the more valuable you are. And then when you work in a mining company, efficiencies are one of your key metrics. And so I think that I felt like in order to be accepted by the guys that I worked with, I really had to produce a lot. And I had to not only produce a lot, but I had to produce things perfectly, because I didn't feel like I had the same margin for error. And as a result, that meant that I felt like I had to put out a lot of work and it had to be perfect work. And to understand sort of polar opposite poles, you know, of putting out a lot of work and putting out perfect work are two polar opposites, and that makes it very difficult. And so I set myself a really high bar. And I think that it made me successful, but I did it at the expense of my own health. I completely wore myself out. And then, of course, I was married and I wanted to, you know, be the have-it-all woman, and I wanted children. So I ended up having two children 18 months apart. I worked on Monday with both children. I worked on Monday and had the babies on Tuesday. And then on 6 weeks later, I went back at the office, and I had read all the books that say that how important it is for you to nurse your children. And so I was bound and determined that I was still going to nurse my children. So I was traveling in my job and I was expressing milk on the road. And my oldest child decided to reverse her days and nights, because she decided she didn't want a bottle during the day. She would wait for me to come home at night, and she would then nurse every 3 hours all night. And so as you can imagine, I got really worn out. And I ended up getting mono. And when I went to the doctor said, well, you've got 3 weeks to 3 months where you're going to be very tired. And I didn't want to miss a day of work, because I didn't want all these guys that I worked with to think that I was somehow weaker than they were, or that being a mother was going to affect my performance. You follow the Enneagram at all, I'm a 3 on the Enneagram, and that's all about performance. So I was in many ways creating my own self-worth by performing superlatively in my mind as an executive and as a mother. And so after 3 months, it hadn't even taken a dent out of the mono. I was still going to work every day, but I was coming home every night and just collapsing on the couch. And you know, that's when I really found out what a good father my husband was, because, or a good parent, because he did really everything with those kids at that point, while I just could hardly do anything. And I also found that I couldn't accept any social engagements or I would get sick, because I'd be too worn out. So, you know, if people were having a party or a dinner, I had to decline. And if anybody in the office got sick, I would get it. And then I would immediately revert back to my early stages of mono, where all I did was sleep all day, every day. And by about the third day, I would feel well enough to wake up and go downstairs and get a glass of orange juice and maybe page through a magazine. And that would exhaust me to the point that I had to go back upstairs and sleep again. I was light sensitive. I couldn't stand any light coming in from the blinds. I was, all of the glands in my body were swollen and sore, right down to my groin. I didn't even know I had glands there. And I was just so ill. I kept going back to the doctor, and the doctor kept filling out the form for the lab tests and sending me off with every box checked, and they all came back negative.
How did that make you feel? What did that do to you, you know, of having all those physical symptoms, but no real answer to them?
I felt helpless. I'm a take action, try to find solutions kind of person. And of course, I would talk to friends and they would say, well, you need exercise. And I'd be like, exercise? I can't walk around the block or I get swollen glands and have to sleep for a day. And, you know, I had all these people suggesting all these things. And my doctor, I remember saying, the doctor saying to me, if you were a different kind of person, I might think that this was in your head. And I said, you know, I get it. But I said, I am getting depressed because I'm sick. Mm-hmm. But I am not depressed, which is making me sick. Mm-hmm. There's a difference. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, she believed me. So I came down with mono in February of 83. And I went for 2 years where I worked, couldn't accept a social engagement, was constantly getting sick if people in the office were sick. I became very germ conscious. Like, I am perfectly trained for COVID. I'm driving my husband nuts. So what happened is they kept sending me to other doctors, specialists. Nobody was coming up with anything. In January of 1985, my doctor sent me, actually she sent me in May of 85 to the special infectious disease department at the university. And they said, we are going to diagnose you as our first case of Epstein-Barr syndrome. And they said Epstein-Barr syndrome only came out in the medical journals in January of 85. And I was diagnosed the first person in our entire province in May of 85. And that was the precursor to what they now call chronic fatigue. Mm-hmm. I basically had run my adrenals to the point where they were so overtaxed, my immune system collapsed. And, you know, they said, well, it's a good news, bad news diagnosis. The good news is you're not crazy. You've got a diagnosis. The bad news is we have nothing we can do for you. So I went home and said, well, if there's nothing that medical science can do for me, there must be something I can do for myself. Now, this was pre-internet. Yeah. I couldn't Google it. I went to the library. I took out every book I could find on people who had cured themselves of terminal illness. And I looked for, like, what did they do? And what I found is that they meditated and they visualized themselves healthy. So then I thought, well, I've got to learn how to meditate. So I went back to the library. I got every book they had on meditation. It was probably 5 slim volumes. I took them home. I read them and I kind of looked for something. I kind of made up my own way of meditating. But every day, twice a day, I relaxed my body. I got out of my head. My head was clearly making me sick, even though because I was too busy in my mind. I got out of my sort of mental and physical body and relaxed and found some inner calmness and peace. Imagined my body healthy, visualized it healthy, told myself positive affirmations. And I can tell you that within weeks, I started noticing differences. Within 3 weeks, I wasn't so tired. Within 6 weeks, someone in the office got a cold and I didn't get it. Wow. Within a couple of months, I accepted a social engagement and I walked around the block and I didn't need to sleep for days and my glands weren't so swollen. So I became a huge believer in the value and importance of taking time to do inner work, to get out of my doing self and become my being self. And I am only down to once a day, but I can tell you that I haven't missed a day of meditating since 1985.
Now that is pretty amazing. That is very amazing. And just for the listeners to keep in mind, 85, that's really pre-internet, that's pre-anything really, pre-meditation classes, pre-YouTube, for the younger listeners, you know, libraries are the rooms where there are books that you need physically to turn the page. And it smells of dust. I love libraries, but it's really pre a lot of things. And I think in 85, not a lot of people knew the word meditation. It hadn't really, I mean, by far not being mainstream. Even, I mean, I'm just asking myself at the end, visualization, was that already a term at the time?
Not much. And I can tell you that, you know, as you can imagine, my friends are fairly conventional. My husband's fairly conventional. For all of them, this was a very woo-woo kind of idea. We lived in an old house that had hardwood floors and not very much insulation. And I had two little girls that I always wanted to make sure they did all the same kinds of things that boys and girls did because of my interest in gender. And I remember being in my room, my bedroom, which had like just one wood door with a hardwood landing at the top of the stairs. And I'm from Canada, everybody plays hockey. My little girls were playing like with floor hockey on the landing outside of my bedroom where I was meditating. And they were, of course, hitting the plastic puck against my door because that was one goal. And I was able to meditate. I was able to get into that inner side. It's kind of like you train your mind to get out of its thoughts and to go inward. And so I remember that I was able to do that, even in the midst of all of that commotion in our house, because there was always commotion. You know, the dog had always just thrown up or something. And what was also interesting was that my husband, who didn't have a feel for it at all, could see the positive benefits for me. And if we had a busy day, he would always say, well, okay, when are you going to find time to meditate? Or you maybe should go upstairs right now and meditate. Like, I got a real support from him in doing it, even though it was completely outside of his sort of realm of experience. And it was interesting. It's interesting also how many of our friends, so a guy that he golfed routinely with, who would never, you know, he sold commercial real estate and was very successful. He put together deals. He was very macho. About, you know, in 2016, he had a heart attack and realized that he needed to do something to improve his health, and he has started meditating. And now, this is somebody that probably then was kind of like, I don't know what she's doing and I don't even want to hear about it. Now he's meditating, and it's something that we share and we talk about it. So it's really very interesting how it has become mainstream and how important it is. There's two words that are out there. One is mindfulness and one is meditation. And mindfulness is really focusing on being in the present moment, which is getting out of all those repetitive thoughts, fears, anxiety. I was at a workshop once where our workshop leader had us get up every morning and take a walk. And as we walked, we were supposed to just look at things in nature and say their name and then describe them. So you would say, tree, leaf, green, smooth, grass, you know, so you would, sky. And so it was her way of getting us to focus on the here and now. And that's mindfulness, and something that probably all of us need all the time. Because if you're somebody like me, that my Enneagram number is a 3 and I want to perform, it's natural for my mind to start planning what I'm going to do that's going to give me satisfaction. So mindfulness is important to just bring yourself into your being and actually take deep breaths, you know, so that you then feel, you kind of, oh yes, I'm in this body. You know, I remember when I was in my worst states, going for a massage, and my massage therapist would say, oh, you've got this huge bruise on your hip. What did you do? And I'd be like, I have no idea. I'm hardly ever in my body. I'm always somewhere else. I'm either in the past rethinking something, or I'm in the future planning something. Like, this is about being in the present. And so mindfulness is chewing your food and really tasting it. It is, you know, when I've had difficult circumstances in my life, I've done things like sit at my desk and just admire the vase that I have sitting there. Like, see the beauty in things that are around you and really listen for a bird chirping, as opposed to just being in such a hurry that you're not listening for it. So that's mindfulness. It allows you to feel joy where you are right now, to see beauty in things and actually feel, you know, I think that allows you to feel love, and there's healing in love, in the power of love. Meditation, what I did with meditation was go a lot deeper internally, where I would go through my body parts and completely say, I relax my toes, I relax the balls of my feet, I relax my arches, I relax my heels. So I would go all the way through my body parts. Some people recommend tensing them and then loosening them. I would just go through to relax. And then I would always surround myself in healing white light. And what I would do is I would really go inward and do inward work, where I would cleanse my chakras. For listeners that aren't familiar, chakras are considered to be the energy points in your body that would be correspond with the primary organs that you have, that you learn about in health at school. And so I would cleanse my chakras, and then I would spend time doing positive affirmations. I would say things like, I choose love, I choose life, I choose health. You're basically programming your subconscious to look for love in the world around you and to be joyful about life because you're choosing it. And then to do what it takes to be healthy, or for your body to respond in healthy ways.
I mean, 85, early 90s, Louisa Hay came around with all those affirmations. Now, today we know that a lot of our behavior is in the vast majority driven by our subconscious, just somehow running those programs from the conditioning, from the family, the culture, from, you know, generations back, everything. Now, we know, at least there are theories, that a positive affirmation said to ourselves, if the subconscious doesn't believe it. So if you say, I'm healthy, and your subconscious says, no, you're not. Or, I'm beautiful. No, you're not. You hear which one I'm choosing. Guess what my subconscious is saying? No, you're not. Now, how can we work with our thick-headed, stubborn subconscious and get those affirmations, get those positive things, or the positive thinking implemented, not just in the conscious mind, because nothing registers there, but deeper? How do we do that?
Such a good question. Let me just even back up a little further and say, one of the affirmations, I think I might have I wonder what year Louise Hay's book, You Can Heal Your Life, came out. Was about 1986?
I must be in the mid, yeah, somehow. I don't
One of the affirmations that I say every day that I included in my daily meditation is from her book. And that is, deep in the center of my being is an infinite well of love. So I think a lot, so first of all, interestingly enough, we use only 10% of our brains consciously. 90% is beneath the surface. And I know this from all of my gender study, babies start discerning the differences at age 3 months. And by 6 months, they are responding to the external world in the way that they believe that they are supposed to behave. So when people say, you know, this is my little boy baby who's acting differently, the research shows that the parents actually, when they're holding babies, if they have a little girl baby, they'll say, look how cuddly she is. And if they have a little boy baby, they'll say, look how squirmy and active he is, where the outside observer notices no difference. So you see how early we're being programmed. And so your question is a good one, because we have these computer tapes, and the way that we can change our belief system is that we bring it to the surface and we realize that there is a different way of thinking about things, and then we put it back down again. And there's a woman named Byron Katie, and she does, and she has all kinds of stuff online that you can look up. And I would really recommend, if people are dealing with belief systems that they think are holding them back, that they should have a look at some Byron Katie work, because she has a program, but the part of the program is that you say something like, when you say, I am healthy, and your subconscious says, no, you're not, you take the opposite of what your subconscious says, and you turn it around, and you find three examples that say, I am healthy. I am healthy because I get out and walk every day, and my body loves to walk, and I know that's positive for my lungs. I am healthy because I make sure I eat something fresh every day. And I am healthy because I think loving thoughts, and love is healing. And then all of a sudden you have this aha where you say, you know, maybe I'm healthier than I thought I was. And that changes your belief system. Now, the thing that's a little bit different than sort of the meditation, because what you're doing when you meditate is that you're getting yourself into a zero zone where you're getting to a point where you're not allowing those thoughts to come in. But naturally, when you're first training yourself to meditate, those thoughts are going, your mind doesn't want to give up control. Your mind loves being in control. And so your brain is really going to try to keep giving you things that is going to keep trying to come back. And what you have to do is you have to say, I am not going to, you say, go away, thoughts, go away. I can't have those thoughts coming in. I don't want to talk to you right now. I'll talk to you later. I'm not going to talk to you right now. So you have to basically expect those thoughts to come. Don't think to yourself, oh, I'm never going to learn to meditate because I can't get rid of those thoughts. I'm just not powerful enough. Just think, no, I'm just going to keep telling them to go away. It's kind of like a little kid pulling on your pants when you're hanging onto your leg and pulling onto your pants, and you're just like, not now, not now, not now. And then you get yourself settled down again. And when you get yourself settled down, then that's when you that's when you can start saying the positive affirmations and reprogramming yourself.
I think, let me just underline one thing, because I think that's very, very important. We all have those thoughts. It's natural to have those thoughts.
Yes.
When I started to meditate, I was one of the ones saying, I can't do that. I'm always thinking. I just can't stop my thoughts. And for me, two ideas, two concepts helped me to, yes, to accept it. One was the comparison with clouds and the sky. You know, the thought is coming, and I just let it pass like a cloud in the sky.
Yes, yes.
And the other one is from a yoga teacher I know. She says, when the thought is coming, just have a chest drawer next to you. Open it later, closed, back to you. And I literally did that during the meditation. The thought would come, oh, I need to do that. Okay. Open the drawer, later, close. Or other thoughts would come where I said, well, I don't want to go back there later. And that would be a drawer, bin, inspiration, or whatever. But these two helped me personally to accept that that is a natural process and that there's nothing wrong with me. And I like your idea of basically using the affirmations in a certain way of, well, I wouldn't say tricking our subconscious, but helping our subconscious to get reprogrammed. Now we've talked so much about it, and we agreed that we would try this experiment and that you would guide us through a meditation.
I would just suggest that everyone, where they're sitting, to just sit comfortably, put your feet flat on the floor, put your hands on your knees. It's helpful even to turn them up and put your index finger against your thumb, because then you're in a receiving mode of the energy. And take a deep breath. Close your eyes and take some deep breaths. And let's just walk ourselves through some relaxation. Let's bring some relaxation into our toes, into the balls of our feet, into our arches, into our heels, up into our ankles and our calves and our knees. Feel the relaxation flowing into your thighs, into your pelvic area, up to your stomach, into your chest, into your neck, and up into your head, down into your face, into your eyes, into your nose and your mouth. And now surround yourself counterclockwise with a healing white light. It starts at the crown of your head and goes all the way down around your body, right down to your feet. And know that you are protected. I want you to imagine that you're getting up and you're walking outdoors. You're opening the door to your house and you're walking outdoors. And there in front of you is a red canoe. I want you to get into that canoe and feel the color of red flowing through your body. Your whole body feels that color of red. And now you get up out of the canoe and you reach for an orange that you see on the tree that's hanging just above the canoe. And you take that orange down and you put your thumb into the peel and you make a hole and you squirt it in your mouth and you feel the color of orange all throughout your body. And you walk ahead and there is a field of the most beautiful daffodils. And you walk along and you feel all the colors of those daffodils. And on the other side of the field is beautiful green grass. And you lay down in that grass and your body, all of you, feels the green of that grass flowing through you. And you look up at the sky and you see the blue of the sky and you feel at one with the sky and you're blue too. Blue like the sky, floating in the sky. And when you come back down ever so gently, there's another tree, and this one has beautiful big plums. and you eat that plum and you feel that color of purple flowing through you. And then you look down and you see a crocus, a beautiful little mauve flower, and you pick it up and you smell it and you hold it against your face, and that color of mauve is flowing through you. So you see, you have all these colors. Imagine them going from red, orange, yellow, green, blue, purple, and mauve. And know that you are connected and cleansed. You're ready to start your day. And open your eyes now.
I don't want to. Thank you. That was beautiful. And I think what is important to note is how simple it is and very fast. How can we incorporate simple meditation steps or mindfulness exercises into our busy schedule? And I make that question a little bit difficult. Incorporating and helping our family to do it with us.
So I verbalized our last meditation, but I am now feeling the effects of having done it as well. So you don't have to just be on the receiving end to feel its benefits. When my children were little and growing up, I did this meditation every night with them before bed. And what that did is it settled them down, but it also settled me down. And so I think that we can incorporate it in our lives by doing it with others, especially if you're a mother and you can do it with your children. There's no doubt that when we are experiencing all of this COVID, it's creating anxiety. Because all of us want our worlds to be predictable. And when they're not predictable, that uncertainty creates anxiety. And we can't control it. We, you know, anxiety puts us in a fight or flight in our systems, and it's something unseen. We can't fight it. We can't flee from it. We don't know. It's invisible. We don't know where it is, and we don't know what we're facing. So all we can do is accept, and I'm back to quoting Byron Katie here, that it's an uncertain universe, but it's a friendly universe. So if we can constantly remind ourselves that what is happening is happening, it's friendly. The universe has a reason. We're going to be better for it. And I'm looking at your poster behind you of Buddha, and I know that there's a Buddhist parable about a man who something negative happens to him, and all his neighbors say, "Isn't that terrible?" And he says, "We'll see." And the next thing you know, that you know, his son fell off the roof and broke his leg, and everybody says, "Isn't that terrible?" And the man says, "We'll see." And the next week, they call all the young men to war, and his young man doesn't have to go because he's got a broken leg. So it ends up being a good thing, and everybody says, "Isn't that good?" And he says, "We'll see." And so the things that we think are bad or good, often with the gift of time, we look back on them and see, wasn't it good that that happened, although it seemed like a crisis at the time? So, you know, I think that letting go of our need to control and to have a predictable universe will help us with our anxiety during COVID. And if we can remember that it is a unpredictable world, but it is an unpredictable universe, but it is a friendly universe. And the things that we think are terrible now might be good in the long term. And the way that we can get out of all of our crazy making thoughts about it is to use mindfulness. And ultimately, mindfulness helps us see the joy in the present. And meditation helps us find the joy in our inner being. And when our outward world is too much, we need, and we haven't been well trained in our world to go inwards. And so that's what meditation gives us. It gives us the ability to find joy regardless of the external circumstances.
Could you maybe think of a couple of examples where we could sense that we are in control of that part in our lives?
Well, I do think that breath is one of the most important things. Like, just that's, you know, our breath happens involuntarily, but we take the time to take a big body breath and expel it. There's all kinds of medical benefits. It lowers our blood pressure. And so I think that is one of the things we can control. And just taking a moment to take back control of our lives by taking some breaths and getting back to the present moment, finding some beauty in some things, just taking a walk, is something we can control if we take control to do that every day.
And have you incorporated gratefulness into your daily
life? Oh, interestingly enough, you know, I was on a call where somebody said, "What has been your COVID silver lining?" And, you know, I think I've become more grateful. Because it's caused me to stop and say, aren't I lucky that I can come to a lake house, that I can look outside and see water? And so I actually have been at night, mentally, before I go to sleep at night, saying three things that I'm grateful for that happened during the day. And what that has done for me is I find that during the day, when I take joy out of something, I think to myself, oh, I have to remember this for night tonight. So I'll remember to, like, it's almost like I'm stopping myself and reminding myself, and that makes the joy bigger.
It's a little bit, the mindfulness practice helps you with the gratefulness.
Yes.
And I think that could also be a really nice ritual around the table with the family.
Yes.
Having dinner and saying, well, looking back at the day, call out three things you're grateful for. I do an exercise at the end of the year when I do a workshop, and I ask the people to write down 50 things they're grateful for the year. And people say, I don't have it. I said, sit down and start. And then at the beginning, it's always the same. There's the big things, you know, I moved to another flat and my kid had that, blah, blah, blah. Now, around number 30, the big things are definitely running out. And I suggest, you know, you look deeper and then the small things come. And when they finish that, the 50, and they come to me, I'm a very, very mean person. I send them away, I say, and now you write another 50. Yeah. And with my family, we had now for the last 2 years, the ritual at the end, so 31st of December, 365 things we're grateful for. Okay, we're four in the family, but writing them down on a wall, and reading them and seeing what the other person wrote down. And sometimes my daughter would write something down and that would make me think, oh yeah, I'm also grateful for that. I think those small things in life are highly underrated for those who are still in the office. I would like to give them something practical, where nobody might notice that they're either taking a deep breath to calm themselves or that they are doing any of these exercises. What would you suggest, especially, let's just take your example, being in a male-dominated environment, open space, you know, people seeing, hearing everything you do. How can you incorporate a little bit of that in your daily practice?
I always found when I was at the office, the most important thing for me was detachment. Because I found that I was there and I would get so wound up in everything that was happening, and I had definite ideas about the way I wanted things to turn out. And that control again gave me anxiety. And so one of the things I really needed to do was practice detachment. So I would find that I would do things, silly as they were, like I would think to myself, well, okay, I am image conscious, so I make sure that I always write with a certain kind of pen because people will look at me and think of me a certain way. So for me to detach, I am going to find the ugliest pen that I can. I'm going to chew the end on it so people will look at it and say, I can't believe that she's using that pen. And I'm going to use it every time that I've got a pencil holder on my desk, and every time that I'm getting overly attached, I'm going to pull out that pencil. And it's going to remind me that I do not need to be attached to this or to what I think people think of me. It's a friendly universe, and maybe things are going to turn out differently than I want, and it's going to be for the good.
Wow, I like that. I like that. I have to get myself an ugly pencil. No, but that's really, because that's one of the hardest thing in business anyway, not getting attached to the outcome. I mean, we're putting so much in, and then it's always, people say, let now go, and the universe do its matching. I'm like, ugly pencil. Yeah, I like that. And that we can always do without anybody noticing it. That's true.
The other thing that I think comes with attachment or outcome, and I talked about it before, which is my desire to do everything perfectly. I actually would challenge myself. I had a paperweight on my desk that said something like, what would I do if I could give up perfectionism? My desire to do things perfectly was keeping me from doing things, because I would feel like maybe the result wouldn't be perfect or wouldn't be as good as I would want. And so I would then challenge myself, and I would say to your listeners as well, find something that's new to you where you likely won't be perfect and try it. It doesn't have to be a big thing. It can be something small, you know, embroidery or cooking something you haven't cooked, or, you know, try something. And be willing to be a failure and treat it as a growth experience. Because that's all ways of detaching.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
And then being able to laugh at yourself. Like, sense of humor to me is one of the greatest way of detaching.
Yes. We shouldn't take ourselves so serious. When you say about perfectionism, in another conversation, and I really like that example. And I invite the listeners to go back to the podcast with Laura. She always wanted to write a book and just couldn't get herself to actually do it. She just, there was that how, and also perfectionism in there. She started by writing, first she did an ebook, but that wasn't enough on the way to a book. She took a class in writing a tiny book. Kind of like, you know, just, what did she say, 50 pages instead of 250 or 500, whatever. And she did that, and she said, and you know what happened? At the end of the class, my tiny book wasn't finished. So I asked the workshop facilitator if I could take the class again. She said, well, you can take it as many times as you want. And she took it a second time, and you know, for the tiny book to be finished. And that kind of also reminds me of you saying, you know, do something you haven't done before. Invite the experience of it maybe not going as smoothly as you had hoped for, and trust that the universe is having your back. trying something new in COVID times. Have you got an idea?
Well, it's interesting. A lot of people, I mean, you've probably seen a lot of the things on Facebook. We went through these phases, certainly in North America, where everybody took up making sourdough bread. And it became a rage. And all these people were comparing notes on whether they were able to get it going and actually rise, etc. I also have read and that a number of people that I wouldn't have expected this from them have taken up jigsaw puzzles. Because, again, you're concentrating on something that's keeping your thoughts away.
I mean, I'm having one upstairs. 18,000 pieces?
Yeah.
And it's true. It's one of those things where, for me, that's meditation. Mm-hmm. That's the time when I really don't think. Mm-hmm. And it's actually, when you talk about it, it's meditation and mindfulness at the same time, because I cannot think about what had happened. I can't plan ahead because I need to look at this piece and where does that go. And it's really an exercise in patience, and it's an exercise in, okay, if I don't find where that piece go, maybe I try another one. It's that letting go of, it has to be this now and it has to be today. No, it can be tomorrow. So that's a beautiful idea. That is really nice. I would like us to finish by going into the direction of affirmations. How can they come up with affirmations that work for them?
Well, Louise Hayes, in her book, of course, her affirmations all start with a health issue. And interestingly enough, I shouldn't get a lot of credit for doing a whole lot of meditation since 1985 because it was precipitated by being very ill. So I felt like I needed to meditate in order to stay healthy. I had a real motivation. So unfortunately, as humans, we tend to get wait until we're in a crisis mode before we adopt a good practice. So in her book, all you have to do is look up, I have a sore knee, and what do knees mean, and then there's a affirmation that you can say. One of the things that I think we make a mistake, our mistake as humans, is that when we visualize what we want, we are way too specific. And so I would caution people when they start doing affirmations not to come up with anything specific like, I'm visualizing a red sports car. I mean, I think you visualize yourself having the freedom to get where you want to be and let the universe decide how it's going to deliver that to you. Maybe it'll be in a bus pass or a person down the road that will drive you all the time. Give the universe an opportunity to give to you what's right for you for your highest good without you being specific about what it is that you want and ultimately possibly disappointed. So I do believe that if we're going to, this all kind of winds up in lands with detachment, which is if we're going to detach, we have to let go of wanting specific outcomes. And in letting go of that, we can open ourselves to maybe allowing the universe to provide us with a better solution. And then we can start paying attention to when that's happened in our lives. So for me, an example would be when I used to sew. And I would walk at lunch through our department store, from my office through our department store to the lunch counter. And that was where all the fabric was sold. And I would find all this beautiful fabric that I would like to make something out of, but it would be too expensive. And I would say, you know, I can't, and I'm just going to let it go. And then a few weeks later, I would walk through and find that somebody had bought most of it, but the amount that I needed was in the sale bin for a price that I could afford to pay. And so that was the universe giving me, without me demanding that I had to have it the first time when it was beyond my budget. So I do think that if we can detach from things, we can allow the universe to supply for us what's right for us but we should visualize what we want in a general sort of way without being too specific. And that's not just visualizations, but also our affirmations.
I like that. So it's really, why do I want the right car? What does it give me? Making sure we understand the deeper motivation, the big why, or people always say, know your why. Why do I want that outcome? What, even if somebody wants some money, wants, you know, step up with the business, put it on another level. Okay, why is that important to you, having a six-figure income? What do you do with that? Okay, and then it's like, oh, well, I can go traveling. Okay, what does the traveling give you? Well, I explore new cultures. Okay, when you're exploring new cultures, what do you learn? You know, so it's really understanding the why behind it. And then if I know the why, well, let's see how I get it. I have a favorite question that I ask at the end of the podcast, and that is, what question would you have liked me to ask you that I didn't? And you could answer that now. Or what point is for you very important and you would like to stress it, you would like to underline it?
Probably the one point that I would like to stress is that we are all energy, and that we are all have a gift that we were put on earth to do. And it's going to be different than everybody else's gift. And so if we're spending time and energy doing what it is that we're meant to do, we're going to have a lot more energy. And so if we're spending time and energy trying to be what other people want us to be, we're going to have a lot less energy. And I think we all need more energy. So I think my ultimate thing that I would always like to say is that I want everybody to be themselves.
And to find that one thing that we are, where we're thriving, where time stand still offline or whatever, but it's, we're just in the zone. And do a little bit of that. If we can't do it full time to make a living, but do a little bit of that.
Yes.
Every day. Betty Ann, I think especially now, talking about these practices, mindfulness, meditation, affirmations, in the midst of what's going on in worldwide, we are in uncharted territory, and we don't have a generation to give us advice on how to deal with the situation, is such a valuable help to everybody that I can't thank you enough that you took the time and spend it with us today.
Thank you for inviting me. I've really enjoyed myself.
You heard a production by Anja Förster. Copyright Anja Förster. Music by audionautics.com.